stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your rights. Get up, stand up. Don't give up the fight.
Preacher man, don't tell me heaven is on the tier.
From the heartland deep in the Ozark Mountains of northern Arkansas, where the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, the Guerrilla Media Network presents The Reynolds Reveal, the new weekly show that, no matter the limitations that may trammel inquiry elsewhere, sifts and winnows without fear or favor. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and today is Tuesday, May 21, 2013. This is episode number 15 of The Reynolds Reveal. I appreciate you listening to the show and therefore being a vital, the most important part of it. And yes, we do welcome your calls here at the Guerrilla Media Network, and the number is 218-862-9829. I'll repeat that at regular intervals later in the show. Today, I'm broadcasting away from my home in the Ouachita Mountains. I'm at Parker's RV Campground near Harrison, Arkansas, not far from the Missouri state line. My wife, Pat, gets the call often to take her nursing skills on the road to nursing homes in Arkansas especially, but sometimes out of state as well. And sometimes I get to go along in our camper on this occasion, and we've got a couple of small but mouthy dachshunds to take as well. Now, the main reason I come up here really is the roads are fantastic. Twisties through the Boston and Ozark Mountains, just great stuff. So I've been out, 3 days in a row. Yeah, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. Very, just wonderful stuff. Now, last night, of course, we had weather that was very iffy, possible tornadoes, but nothing touched ground here except some lightning and light rainfall. It was thundery, stormy. Thank heavens that we didn't suffer the devastation that occurred in Moore, Oklahoma. I've been watching a lot of that coverage. It's just god-awful. Well, on the Reynolds Reveal, last week we had quite a show. My special guest was Professor Hunt Tooley of Austin College in Sherman, Texas. And we discussed World War I based on his 2003 book, The Western Front. And the question, big question is, why discuss that war? It started nearly 99 years ago, so isn't that done and buried and no lessons to be learned? On the contrary, au contraire, because the reason it's so important, it moved Western nations, Western governments, from a century of emphasis on individualism, private property, free markets, and honest money. It accelerated the trend to collectivism, socialism, massive intervention, regulation, and dishonest money. And all the horrors of the 20th century, which includes Nazism, Soviet communism, Italian fascism, genocide, and the whole warfare, welfare state that we have in so many Western governments today, they date from the Great War. And what about today? Well, the preview is I have two special guests. Both are physicians with MD behind their name. Dr. Jerome Arnett Jr., who is a pulmonologist in West Virginia, and his daughter, Dr. Brenda Arnett, who is an internist or a doctor of internal medicine. She practices in Winchester, Virginia. If that name Arnett sounds familiar, It may be because I had Jerome's son and Brenda's brother on an earlier episode of the Reynolds Reveal. His name, Brian Arnett. He's a craft brewer, restaurateur, entrepreneur from West Virginia. So this is another episode of All in the Family, you might say, because I've married into this fabulous Arnett family. So I've got easy access to boots on the ground again. Only this time, it's boots on the ground in the practice of American medicine. So we're going to learn a lot about the inside of American medicine over many decades. And we've got two generations here of country docs. And we're going to get their views on public policy with Obamacare looming especially, but all kinds of other fascinating issues. First, though, before we interview our physicians, we got Reynolds Reveal comments to make on the news before our first break. And today I want to discuss Pope Francis's condemnation of money and capitalism. You might have noticed this about 5 days ago, but as a professional economist, I've got to cannot let this go. One of the articles on the web, pretty good stuff, was some thoughts on Pope Francis's recent condemnation of capitalism. Well, you might have noticed the a couple of these articles. One of them was in the Daily Mail and another the Telegraph. The Brits seemed to pick up on this pretty big. What did Pope Francis say? Well, he called on world leaders to end the cult of money. That was his first speech on financial crisis. And he labeled money a form of tyranny. Well, this is maybe poetic, but or mysticism, or mystical, but it I'm not quite sure what he's saying, that money is the boss, is tyrannical. Now, one good thing about what he's saying is he's being explicit, all right. The Pope goes on, money should be made to serve people, not to rule them. To serve people, well, it does. And I'm going to elucidate how, the many ways in which it does serve people. He called for a, quote, more ethical financial system and curbs on financial speculation. Well, there he's got an element of truth about the deterioration of ethics in the financial system, the lack of fiduciary responsibility by financial agents on behalf of their investors. The Pope further said, countries should impose more control over their economies and not allow absolute autonomy in order to provide for the common good. We got a lot of collectivism going over there. It's almost laughable that the Pope would say, our problem is a lack of sufficient controls over the economy. I mean, it's just, what isn't controlled or what part of life doesn't have substantial intervention by central governments? Now, the Pope is clearly no friend of capitalism, therefore is no friend of individual property rights, therefore is no friend of individual liberty, more broadly put. Let's get some more of what the Pope is issuing on capitalism and money. While the income of a minority is increasing exponentially, declares the Pope, that of the majority is crumbling. Unquote. The income of the majority is crumbling. Well, here again, he's got a piece of the truth. But why is this a problem? If money is evil, if income, working for income is evil, then the evil must be diminishing for a majority of the people. Well, why isn't this to be applauded? Well, you know, he fancies himself a special agent of the poor. but with his kind of help, I'm not sure he's going to help the poor. In fact, if his policy recommendations are followed, it's going to harm the poor. Well, the Pope also declares that unchecked capitalism is responsible for generating, quote, a new invisible and at times virtual tyranny, unquote. Oh, me, oh, me, oh, my. Well, we've got all kinds of problems. One is the Pope really doesn't propose any alternative to private property and free markets. Furthermore, the Pope doesn't ask, well, where did these developed countries come from? Why did they develop? What was the big eradicator of poverty? It wasn't the ideology of the Dark Ages or the medieval period. In fact, it must have been the new ideology promoted by Adam Smith and less famous economists and the founding fathers, and the whole idea of liberty, not only liberty in the political sphere, but all very vitally in the economic sphere. It's essentially freedom that the Pope is really attacking or despises. And he's looking for more controls, top-down controls. Haven't we learned our lesson, Pope? You know, as an economist, the Pope makes a mighty fine priest. This is one of the aggravating things that I have. Everybody has some respect for physics, chemistry, biology, the sciences, the hard engineering disciplines, but they can even though some of the brightest people in history have studied economics because it is terribly important. It's not the be-all, end-all of life, but it's an important means that we thrive and prosper and can pursue these more noble aims to enable that by high productivity labor. And he just ignores all this. The guy doesn't know diddly about economics. Now, at one level, this is a variation on a theme. Usually the men of the cloth scorn or denounce selfishness. But that plays in here too, doesn't it? Capitalism allows you to pursue individual purposes provided they're peaceful. And what could be less harmful than pursuing productivity and wealth by serving consumers and other businesses? Now, this Pope, I'm wondering if they vetted him very well in the College of Cardinals, because he chose the name Francis, St. Francis of Assisi, and you need to read his bio. He's known as a patron saint of animals and the environment for a good cause, because apparently he believes in equality in the eyes of God. Men are no better, I guess, than insects, and they're all equal in God's eyes. Well, you can see how some of these religious types can get so unanchored as that. Now, policy analysis for the Pope's information has three components. One is state the problem. Number two, state the causes. And number three, state how your solution or policy will address those causes. Now, this makes perfect sense. If you've got a mechanical problem, you got to discover what caused the problem. Is it just a blown fuse? Is it some other problem? Is it not plugged in, your appliance not plugged in? Is there a mechanical problem? You got to discover the cause before you can administer a good solution. That's true in the social arena as well. It's true in medicine. It's true in all aspects of life. You got to discover the causes, and then your solution has got to address those. Now, if the Pope wants to go so far as to abolish money, the whole system is doomed. We're going to have mass starvation, an implosion of productivity, all kinds of outcomes the Pope, I think, would abhor. Now, the reason that we use money is because of the infirmities of barter, right? Barter depends. I bring one bag of feathers for pillow, and I'm looking for a new inner tube for my bicycle tire. Well, I got to find this perfect coincidence of wants. I got to find somebody who wants my, who's willing to trade their bicycle inner tube. Well, the money is a general medium of exchange. It obviates all those infirmities of barter. So now, one time, on a major scale, the communists actually tried to ban money, and that was Pol Pot and the murderous Khmer Rouge. You might recall the Killing Fields, the British movie in 1984 that won three Academy Awards. Now they don't, of course, they aren't going to explain any of this. What the ideology that was driving the true communists, the pure communists. We aren't going to have any residual property rights on a dispersed individual basis. No, we're going to get rid of money. We're going to get rid of private property. We're going to re-educate everybody into becoming the socialist man. We're going to abolish money and trade. Cities are evil. We've got to march everybody into the countryside to live the wholesome agrarian life. Now, whoever controls the means of production controls the means of life. In capitalism, this is dispersed private property. Right, there's no central authority controlling the means of production. Now, this whole Khmer Rouge, Pol Pot episode of pure communism, of course, was a complete unadulterated failure. All ambitious socialist schemes are complete failures. And I'm going to take another occasion to explain exactly why that is deep explanation. You are listening to The Reynolds Reveal, and I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and we are going to talk American medicine with two practicing doctors on the other side of the break. So come on back.
Broadcast brought to you by the Rhythm Media Network. Ever ask yourself, where do the towers go? Well, if you want the truth, if you can handle the truth, tune in Thursdays and Fridays from 5 till 7 Pacific Coast Time. Dr. Judy Wood is doing a program called ICU PSYOP Recovery Program, addressing your questions, your curiosities, your mysteries regarding that fateful day. So it's a character-driven production on Guerrilla Media Network, 5 to 7, Thursdays and Friday evenings, Pacific Coast Time. If you can handle the truth, tune in.
Do you owe the IRS more than $10,000? Well, it happens to the best of us. Just ask Charlie.
I was a pro NFL player, defensive back. Yes, I did get a letter from the IRS.
It's a scary thing, even for a big man like Charlie.
Well, man, when you see those dreaded letters, capital IRS, $60,000, man, you almost drop to your knees. You know, they were trying to levy my accounts, garnish me, real bad situation.
Charlie found out about the law offices of Craig Zimmerman.
I heard their commercial on the radio. I said, well, hey, let me give them a call. It was like talking to my brother, talking to a great friend. I called Craig Zimmerman, and they put a stop to it.
You'll love the way they do business.
Like we say in the NFL, they never drop the ball. They did a great job for me.
You may be able to significantly reduce your tax debt. Call the law offices of Craig Zimmerman and get your game plan. 800-638-0727.
Craig Zimmerman, they threw a touchdown for me.
Call now and find out how much you can save. 800-638-0727. 800-638-0727.
Mamma Mia's Authentic Italian Cooking Company. Hand-rolled traditional-style Italian cookies from recipes passed down through the generations from Sicily to Louisiana. A taste of the old world can now be savored and made a tradition in every home worldwide. Imagine the delight of your family and guests when they bite into the authentic taste of Italy at your next family holiday or special occasion. Mamma Mia's Authentic Cookie Company, preserving the art of Italian baking and providing you with quality, delightful cookies that you will enjoy for years to come. 14 different Italian cookies sold by the pound and FedEx to your door. Could anything be more convenient? Visit MamaMia's.com and browse in Mama's Cookie Gallery for ideas for your next party and custom cookie order. Beautiful cookies baked in America, inspired by Italy and Mama's love. Mamma Mia's Authentic Italian Cookies. Traditional, convenient, and delicioso. Biscotto molto buono.
Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds. And we here at the Guerrilla Media Network do welcome your calls, especially for first-time callers. The number is 218-862-9829. And today, it's my special pleasure to welcome to the Reynolds Reveal two physicians whom I admire and maybe even love. And it's great to be married into the Arnett family. There's a bunch of talented people. And a couple of weeks ago, I had Brian Arnett on, the craft brewer and restaurateur from West Virginia. And today, I am most pleased to have his dad, Dr. Jerome Arnett Jr. Welcome, Jerry, to the Reynolds Reveal.
Thanks, Morgan. I'm delighted to be here.
Great to have you, and his daughter, also a NMD, practicing as an internist, I guess that's pronounced right, a doctor of internal medicine in Winchester, Virginia, Dr. Brenda Arnett. Welcome.
Thanks, Morgan. It's great to be here.
And, hey, medicine and health is so important, almost a prerequisite to all the good things in life, and it's so important to have you two on, discuss this, your own practices, a little insight into what attracted you into medicine and where we are now and the various problems. I call them some natural and some synthetic, mostly associated with government. But Jerry, Dr. Jerome Arnett, your dad was Jerome Arnett, correct?
That's correct.
And he was an MD, so we've got three generations of physicians. So it's such a hard road to become a practicing physician. What motivated you? It's a complicated thing, but what are the first things that come to mind? Why did you go into medicine?
Well, I went largely because I could be free to try to help other people and to choose my work. And at the time I went in, of course, we did not have Medicare or these other programs.
Okay, so there was a part of the attraction was freedom.
That's correct.
Okay, now Brenda, you were born into a family with the man as a physician, and you eventually, out of the three children, chose medicine. What attracted you into medicine?
Well, definitely not my father's discouraging words about it, because he watched medicine change. He actually discouraged me from going into medicine, and I was pretty interested in cancer research, so I did a lot of lab stuff, but I just could not stop finding myself and reading all I could about diseases and humans. So I tried to fight it, but I fell into it because I love it. So different from my father, I guess.
You know, it's interesting. Of course, Brian said you should find out something you love because you're going to put so many hours into it.
Exactly.
Yeah, that was true of me, too. Now, what about the money part of it? Some of us explicitly aren't going to pursue the big bucks, but we want to be comfortable, of course. But what role did that play in your own motivation?
Dad, you want to talk about that first? We were
never wealthy. Our family has never been wealthy, and the ability to earn a decent money has always been very important in my life, and I recognize it is the only way that I could really be independent and raise a family.
Now, I remember being, I was on Capitol Hill for 1 year with the Joint Economic Committee as a visiting professor, scholar, and the big issue was fighting Hillary Care, so I learned quite a bit about policy in that whole debate. We basically harpooned Hillary Care to death. I remember sitting at a luncheon, one of these conferences, and a doctor on in years was saying that the people who go into medical school are a lot different than when he did, because especially they want to be salaried and part of a clinic or some big organization, HMO or whatever. And that was much different than the independent practitioner, where you're more of a little bit of a free enterprise or entrepreneur. You got to build your own a practice, right, Jerry?
That's correct. Part of that has to do with the impressions you get when you're developing in your family life of the importance of having the ability to earn a good living. Nowadays, the students coming out of the government enforced school system seem to have a little different perspective about their ability or their need to contribute to other folks in their work.
Explain that. I don't quite understand what you mean.
Well, for example, it's been so difficult in private practice over the earlier decades, because of the severe requirement of almost 24-hour on-call and all hours of the night being called out and working. And some of the newer students coming on don't understand that and have decided to opt for a more structured position where they're salaried and they have much less night work and a much better ability,
okay,
I suppose, to spend with their family, see?
Yeah, well, that's pretty natural, I suppose.
That's right.
Provided that the patient, of course, has proper care by other means, right, when you're not on call.
That's right.
I mean, what about, you made a statement here to me when we had a little conference call. I thought that was very important about the philosophy of a physician. And you said the practice of the healing arts is partly an art and partly a science, and that's influenced by the physician's philosophy. And I mean, it worries me that so much of medicine nowadays is formulaic and driven by guideline, best practice, so-called, and, you know, where is the whole, I want to get your and Brenda's reaction to this. This whole, I guess the art is being lost somehow. It maybe that's one way to put it, in the whole physician-patient relationship.
Well, one of the most important things in facing and approaching your work and your life in dealing with your friends and neighbors is that is your ethical approach to that, and that's, of course, that's a part of philosophy, your philosophy. But medicine is a profession. It's not a trade. It's been trying, I think it's been going more toward a trade recently, if that's what you're noticing, I think. A profession is different from a trade because it has a code of ethics. In medicine, we have what's called a code of medical ethics. It's not an enforced law, but it's an objective to strive towards so you can do a better job in your work. And our ethical responsibility is to fight against that which harms our patients too.
Yes. And, hey, as an economist, it reminds me of the language we use is there's a principal-agent relationship here where the principal, you may not like this parallel or metaphor, but the principal is the patient and the agent is the physician. In other words, the agent or physician is supposed to operate in the best interest of the principal or a patient. It's the same with, you know, the fiduciary responsibility of somebody managing an investor's money. Same ethical idea. Does that make sense?
Yes, that's why it's so important for the physician in our practice in taking care of patients to be able to have the freedom to choose what we feel is best and not to be restricted by other things that have come into the modern healthcare system, such as electronic medical records, of course, Medicare, evidence-based medicine, and all of these, a lot of these things, and of course, the new maintenance of certification are all designed to control more or less the physician and tell him to do what the higher-ups in the medical boards want us to do, and sometimes that means that we're aligned, we're being aligned to provide societal-based objectives of certain people, and the things that are used to control us are what's called evidence-based medicine, and that leads to practice guidelines, and that...
Okay, evidence refers, what, to outcomes? By these studies, is that what
evidence is in evidence-based medicine? Evidence is decided by a committee of the big boys in medicine who sit around and decide what we should be doing and what we shouldn't. And they review articles, scientific articles, and it's a committee decision. They come to a conclusion, but many times the independent physician may not agree with this type of approach and may have a different idea as to what's best for the patient. That's the problem.
Amen. Yeah, the central committee. Now, Dr. Brenda Arnett,
yes.
Your experience being so recent, I was really struck by, after all these years of hard work and training, education and residency, and you went to a clinic. And please retell the experience and why you were discouraged there and then struck out on your own.
Yeah, when I was fresh out of residency, for a year, I joined a multi-specialty group. So 2 to 3 internists, an endocrinologist, gastroenterologist. So call was a little hairy as far as covering specialty call. But we basically had to see 30, the goal was 30 to 40 patients a day. And when you see a general internal medicine patient, most of them, I mean, 60s, 70s, at least 65 plus on Medicare, on average they have about 18 medical problems. And it lasts for about 15-minute visits to go through 18 medical problems, even if it was a new patient to me. And I couldn't sleep at night just over and over in my head thinking about all the things I was missing. And the poor, you know, it was just terrible patient care. It just seems like the trend in medicine is definitely not focused on the patient anymore. So I finished my year contract out and decided I couldn't do that anymore. So I decided to open my own practice. where I don't take insurance. So I do discounted rates, physician rates, and I do discounted blood work, any kind of, you know, B12 injection if you need it, just very discounted, and I have tried to cut out the middleman. So that way I can tell
you. Let me interrupt Brenda say, weren't you were kind of a prize graduate, et cetera, so you had options to
go.
Yes.
I did. Yeah.
But it would have been a similar result elsewhere, I suppose, huh?
Yeah, I think it would have been similar anywhere, any group I had joined. Just the insurance pace. It's just not for me. I felt like I wasn't taking good care of people. I couldn't sleep at night. And I mean, I did it. I can do it. Everyone can do it. When you go through residency, you can do something like this. But it's giving really terrible care to the patient. Too much paperwork, too much bureaucratic decisions being made by someone else that has no idea or anything to do with the patient. So it's really disturbing, actually.
Amen. Yes. We've got to learn more about that. And your individual practice allows you to act in the best interest of your patients. You are listening to The Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds. And there's the break. Fine. And we've got to return and discuss more about modern American medicine and its apparent deterioration in old law.
Dr. Judy Wood, author of Where Did the Towers Go? And you're listening to the Guerrilla Media Network.
Ever ask yourself, where do the towers go? Well, if you want the truth, if you can handle the truth, tune in Thursdays and Fridays from 5 till 7 Pacific Coast Time. Dr. Judy Wood is doing a program called ICU PSYOP Recovery Program, addressing your questions, your curiosities, your mysteries regarding that fateful day. So it's a character-driven production on Guerrilla Media Network, 5 to 7, Thursdays and Friday evenings, Pacific Coast Time. If you can handle the truth, tune in.
Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds. We here at the Guerrilla Media Network do welcome calls. The number 218-862-9829. And this afternoon, I've got two wonderful people who are physicians and are going to tell us about the problems in the medical. We should stop for a moment and think about the successes and the rewards. And Dr. Brenda Arnett in Winchester, Virginia, there must be some what economists would call psychic rewards, a feeling of achievement that you're serving your patients well now that you have more degrees of freedom to treat them in the way you think serves them best.
Absolutely. And I noticed that my first year, so I only practiced in a group for a year. My first year of my 8 years of doing this, I had several examples within the first few months because I was able to take a lot more time to take a history. I had a patient who, at the time, we didn't know it. He had an infection in his heart. He had just seen his cardiologist the Friday before he saw me on a Monday, and nothing was caught. He just felt really awful. But he didn't actually say, I'm having fevers and chills, but because I could take 15 or 20 minutes to ask him just the history, I found out that he was, you know, drenched in the morning and ripping the sheets off, changing his clothes. You know, I could tell he was having severe temperature changes. So I was able to get blood cultures and, you know, an echocardiogram of his heart, and there was a big vegetation on his valve. And I mean, it just really, it is rewarding because I feel like I can take my time and I pick up on things that other specialists even can miss just because I just have more time. I'm not trying to flatter myself with smartness. I take more time and you can get a better history. People just are able to speak more what they're feeling and you can just tease it out a lot better with more time. I also, I can order the tests I want to order. I still have to fight with insurance companies on occasion because you still have to get prior auth for scans, but I do have a lot more freedom.
Yeah, excellent. Jerry, what about your experience? You've been at this a long time, going back to the first days of Medicare. Prior to Medicare, were things better for physicians' independence in serving their patients?
Well, things were cheaper. I can remember in my father's practice over in Preston County, West Virginia, when I can first remember as a child, I believe that back in the 50s, his office charge for an office visit was $5.
A dollar?
$5.
$5, okay.
Nice.
I remember, you're both members of the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons, which is the free enterprise-oriented association, right? And I remember Dr. Jane Orient seems to be the founder or the activist leader, that she, during the Hillary Care battle on the Hill, had a copy of her the hospital charges, maybe physicians included, for her delivery, like in 1949, and the whole bill was $94. Yeah.
Yes.
But okay, so LBJ, in the aftermath of JFK's assassination, gets through all these programs, one of which is Medicare, which was going to be very low-priced addition to help seniors in their medical travails. So what's your early recollection? Right away, they're telling you what tests you can and cannot order and when to discharge patients, or how did this evolve?
Well, a lot of the physicians now have come to realize that American physicians are working harder and harder for less and less in order to support a dysfunctional system. Now, the system is fraught with regulations and thousands of rules and high penalties in case one of these little rules is broken. For example, Medicare consists of 132,000 pages of regulations.
And it's my, is that all?
And it's estimated that hospitals spend about 38,000 man-hours a year, each hospital, in order to comply with these regulations. And, in fact, in the care of a hospital patient, 30 minutes is spent on paperwork per hour of patient care. Now, I can remember back before Medicare was put in, and I remember the first time I saw that was when I was a fellow in pulmonary medicine at the Ochsner Clinic in New Orleans, and I saw that outside people were coming in and reviewing records. In fact, I think this happened also in Charity Hospital in New Orleans when I was in internal medicine, and I was shocked because, you know, to that point I was assuming that medical records were perfectly private. Oh, yeah, they were still going to be private, but that was the first thing that I noticed, and then when I got out in private practice, I found out that, as Brenda says, the Medicare patients have the highest number of problems, require the longest time, and under the Medicare system, I was paid the least amount to take care of these massively time-consuming and complicated patients, and then after that, the hospital had a special secretary to go around and tell me, I think she was called a discharge nurse, and tell me when it was time to discharge my patients, what the tests I could get on the patients in the hospital, and then wait to out of the hospital. And I got so upset and discouraged that I just gradually phased that out. And
phased it out means that you, as an independent physician, would refuse to see a Medicare patient, or how does that work?
I just stopped taking care of Medicare patients in my practice. I made sure all my patients had other options, of course, to get care, mm-hmm. but I quit participating in the program. And the other main thing was, it scared me, and it scares physicians today terribly, it's a terrible burden for today's physicians, are the terrible, huge, and numerous penalties that are applied to the physicians if something little goes wrong.
Okay. Yeah. This will be 10 years in the federal hoosgow or whatever. Yeah, all these draconian punishments. Yeah. I guess that would say, you know, to get the best care, we need to strike fear into the practicing physician. Yeah, that seems like a sound incentive system. Oh, my.
It's part of the centralized control that's being used in order for the system to work. See, it's a socialist system. It's based on the a government price-fixing scheme that's based on the Marxist labor theory of values, which you know, and unlicensed, unaccountable, and incompetent government bureaucrats arrogantly presume to know the correct price for every medical service. Now, it ignores, of course, as you know, this ignores human nature because humans aren't made to do this and work this way. And it ignores fundamental economic laws. And so doctors end up treating regulations more than the patients. And that's the ethical problem that we find about it.
And Morgan, you know, 50% of my patients are actually Medicare patients. I think they've gotten really frustrated with 10 and 15-minute visits at other physicians' offices and end up here. But to actually see a Medicare patient and opt out, they actually make it very, very difficult. So you have to sign a contract with – well, first of all, you have to opt out from Medicare. So you, no matter what, I guess it's just assumed you are a part of – you're branded as a Medicare physician until you request permission from them to opt out. You have to do this every 2 years. Then when you see a Medicare patient, you have to have them sign individually. It's a two-page contract. Each line has to be initialed. And then both of us have to sign it. It has to be readily available in my front office, and it's also got to be readily available in the chart. And it just, it's a contract that says over and over again, you know, the patient's aware I've opted out of Medicare. They won't try and get money from Medicare just for my services. So they make it very, very difficult to get out of their system. So, mm-hmm. But you know.
Yeah, I guess it could get more draconian. That's a scary thought. You know, in other words, making it more and more difficult for independent private medicine to exist.
Yeah, they are definitely doing that. The most recent thing is they're talking about if you aren't a Medicare physician, then you might at some point not be able to order lab work. Because, see, right now I can order labs, chest x-rays, any kind of studies. I can refer to specialists, and it works. So it's just the fee that they don't get reimbursed for. It's just my office. And that's usually very doable at least for the good care they get around here with my Medicare patients. But if they get more and more stringent and just try and make it harder and harder for physicians to opt out, it's going to be a nightmare.
I would like to know what's the relationship between the independent physician and hospital privileges. Is there a special problem there or not? Is that everything's okay?
Well, I can answer. When I quit taking, gave up my Medicare practice, which was a large part of my practice, I gave up my hospital privileges. I did not admit patients to the hospital.
I had to too. You can't. You really can't. You can't opt out of Medicare and admit to the hospital. It's required. If you work in a hospital, you usually have to take Medicare.
So for a patient who should be, how does that does he or she need another physician to admit them?
Well, the trend is that there are hospitalists now that just staff the hospital. So a lot of internists don't even admit in general, regardless of whether or not you take Medicare or not. So that's just a really common thing these days.
I see. Okay. The music suggests we are approaching a break. This is Steve Reynolds Rizzuto. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and I'm discussing modern medicine and its ills with two wonderful doctors named Arnett. So to learn more, let's talk to them after the break.
Are you over your head in debt and not sure what to do? Did you know there's a way to legally wipe out debt? Stop harassing phone calls, even stop foreclosure or repossession? Well, the answer is yes. Pick up the phone right now and call the bankruptcy hotline at the law offices of Craig Zimmerman. With 17 years' experience as a practicing attorney, Craig knows how to get the creditors off your back and get you peace of mind. Most people don't realize that bankruptcy is a great alternative by immediately stopping collection calls, allowing you to keep your home, eliminate all of your debt, and give you a fresh start. Call now for a free, no-obligation consultation at 800-281-2286 and learn how bankruptcy could help you. So stop wondering what to do with your debt and call us at 800-281-2286. 800-281-2286. Not all will qualify. The law offices of Craig Zimmerman is federally designated as a debt relief agency. Office is located in Dallas and Santa Ana, California.
Pittman & Davis is a family-owned company that's been in business for over 80 years, specializing in delivery of fresh fruit, smoked meats, cheeses, pastries, and other scrumptious gift food items.
What's more, Pittman & Davis gift food selections are meticulously prepared to ensure the finest quality possible and made in small batches to be shipped fresh daily.
Pittman & Davis, fresh fruits and gifts since 1926. Visit thepetesantillishow.com/gift right now to see their selections.
For a little ride.
Now you can share the topics that drive the discussions of your favorite talk shows with TalkStream Live's topic-driven talk radio.
We gotta talk. Take a drive.
List and promote real-time talk radio topics or post the topics that you want to hear. Hot topics are tweeted and retweeted and include simple click-to-listen audio links. The future of talk radio is topic-driven talk radio.
Well, that's what I call real drive.
Available now at TalkStreamLive.com.
Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and today we are discussing American medicine with two active physicians. One is Jerome Arnett Jr., a pulmonologist in West Virginia, and then his daughter, who went into medicine despite Jerry's discouragement of such a career path. Dr. Brenda Arnett, an internist from or practices in Winchester, Virginia. And hey, you know what? There's a parallel here in this whole business of the more and more federal involvement, regulation, money, third-party payments, and regulation. And Dr. Jerome Arnett here, Jerry's old enough, as I recall, too. In the 50s, there was talk about we've got to, improve the schools, and we've got this wonderful money machine called the federal government. And all they need to do is spread more money around in the schools, and they'll improve. And, of course, there won't be any stick to go with this carrot. There won't be any regulations and the like. We've almost got something parallel here where – there's just going to be more money. There's going to be it goes back to Blue Cross Blue Shield, the whole World War II making medical insurance as a benefit to get around wage regulations during the war and all kinds of stuff back in history. And now we've got this massive third-party involvement, not just by the federal government, but all kinds of insurers. And that sure isn't going to go – none of that's going to go away. It's going to get worse, isn't it, under the Patient Protection and ACA, Obamacare for short. It looks like it's going to get worse and worse, doesn't it, Jerry Arnett?
It surely doesn't look good.
Grim.
How about your daughter? Is she going to be able to, continue practice without too much harm? What do you see happening?
I mean, it could go either way, but I'm actually pretty positive because I think people seek me out because I take more time and I give better care. And I have gotten, probably about 9 months ago, I started getting a lot more phone calls from other physicians across the country, kind of picking my brain. A lot of them were emergency medicine physicians, and they wanted to open an urgent care, kind of the way I run my practice. So I got a slew of phone calls from Vermont and California, pretty much all over the country, trying to mimic what I do and how did I do it, and you know, even questions like, what EMR did I use? And I do continue to get new patients that have gotten bad care in other places. So it may get pretty popular because I think people are going to get more and more frustrated. But I guess it depends on the regulations that Obama decides to pass because there is a possibility I could be limited.
What would be the fee for a typical patient up front, a new patient, with the normal problems, if there is such a thing? I mean, are we talking $150 or, for that first visit?
Yeah, anywhere from $100 to $200. And it's, I spend 90 minutes with every new patient. And it's based on, I had to keep, unfortunately, the same system that Medicare has. So they have these CPT codes for, it's supposed to be based on complexity. You're not supposed to base it on time. So if someone has two or three medical problems, that's a 99202, for example. And that's my lowest charge. And then I basically made it simple. They have hundreds of codes. I just pick three. So an easy, less complicated patient, younger, and then the medium, and then, of course, Medicare with 18 medical problems would be the highest charge. So, but I do, I've discounted blood work. My EKGs are cheap, $40 for an EKG. An injection, B12 would be $10. I mean, I just tried to keep, of course, the middleman out, which made my prices a lot cheaper.
So Morgan, what Brent is trying to tell you is that the price system in medicine over the last 50 years has been destroyed by the government price fixing scheme that's embedded in Medicare, and therefore a new physician, and I have the same problem here in the rural area where I work, the physician, one of the most difficult things about a physician who's going to work and charge, if there's no price system and no structure, we don't know how to charge.
Yeah,
you don't know what to charge.
We don't know how to charge because how do we set that up? The Medicare system doesn't apply to us, and we don't know. So you kind of have to do that by trial and error. I think that's what Brenda did.
Yeah,
I did. I did shift my prices quite a bit over the years, trying to figure out how to do this because I don't like to see more than 15. I usually see 10, maybe 12 patients a day. So. Mm-hmm. You kind of have
to. Yeah, that's what David A. Stockman would call price discovery. Yeah, there's a certain kind of groping in the dark, but it does work out. And
right.
What about this whole, of course, as an economist, we think about independent enterprises with different themes or some variation in types of services and goods and but all operating independently, the market is big and rich and varied, and a lot of this is being squashed by running everything through the same sausage machine, and you're a couple of outliers there. Right? I mean, there's this homogenization going on, this formulaic stuff. I think of medicine as, well, they do some tests. Maybe they're not looking at my history, my family's history, the way Brenda does. So right away there's a problem. You got tests, and then you got big pharma, and then you got cutting, right? Surgery and big pharma. But there's really not much in the way of, what should we say, nutrition and lifestyle and that kind of advice to avoid or delay disease in American medicine.
Correct.
Do you do some of that, Brenda?
Yeah, actually, I do a lot of preventative medicine. Most people come here wanting to, which is nice, talk about that. It's not very, you don't have time. There's no way I had time to do it when I was in the other practice for a year. So I never even got into that. You know, now I can even, you know, the last, when you do a soap note on a patient, the last part is like what you're going to do about everything. So, and you number it. That's just how you're taught to do it in medical school. But the last one is, you know, I have time to put health maintenance, you know, up to date with tetanus. I can go through all their vaccines, you know, up to date with colonoscopy, dex. I mean, I have time to do that and make sure they have every single, you know, preventative measure done. So, and that's, I think, just taking really good care of patients. So I didn't have time to do that.
Before we went on air, we discussed a series of issues, and I want to bring up one now, Brenda, and that is that is creating a problem in your life, something called maintenance of certification, MOC, yes. MOC. So tell us about why the imposition on you as a practicing and successful independent physician.
It's a lot of time and a lot of money that I feel like gets me nowhere. So I think it's a waste of time. I think it's another bureaucratic intervention that's been imposed on us. So every 7 to 10 years, you have to recertify. You know, I'm an internal medicine physician, so I have to take the internal medicine board. So it's a 2-day exam. It is 16 books to study for it. It's a big test. I can understand the testing part to keep physicians up to date. That fee with the test and to sign up for this whole process is $3,000.
Wow.
Yeah, just for the test fee and the fee to sign up for the website. And the new thing is this practice improvement module. So there's all these little parts of the certification, not just the test, to try and make you a better doctor is, of course, what they claim. So one that I, for example, just to give an example, you have to do a chart review in your office, you know, because this is supposed to make you a better physician. You have to pick a topic. So, for example, I picked osteoporosis, and I had to review 50 charts. And, you know, interestingly, it's a lot of data entry that is too complicated to be done by anyone but the physician. So it does start to make you think you're doing, you're paying them to do free data entry. So I put a zip code in for the patient, male or female, you know, how old they are. You know, are they Medicare? Are they private insurance? I mean, very specific data entry questions that, to me personally, don't make me learn anything, so it does make you suspicious. So anyway, you get a series of questions that you answer. Did you check someone's vitamin D? If so, yes. You know, well, when? You have to go back and put the date. Okay, if you did, what's the number? So each time you're answering it, you're like trying to flip through the chart, finding all this stuff. I mean, each chart review takes you 45 minutes at least. After you're done with the 50, they give you the score. And, of course, I got a zero. I mean, I did very well, except there was one question I got wrong every time, and it was, you know, what was your patient's maximum height at a young age, and did you document this in the chart? So, personally, I don't have, I mean, as much time as I get to take,
they want to do a height shrinkage study with your data.
Right, but to be honest, you know, you see these patients, you couldn't include a patient that you didn't know for 4 or 5 years. So you get their height once a year. Every internal medicine doctor does that because it's good medicine and you can see if they're shrinking. So you already know whether or not to address that part of it. But I got a 0% on that because, of course, I never did that. And then you get the option of, do you want to do 50 more chart reviews on the same exact set of questions, a full set, or do you want to, you know, make this succinct and just answer the question you got wrong for 50 people. So it's just, I don't know that that's a very good learning example to me.
My question is, okay, this is required every 7 to 10 years by the American Board of Internal Medicine. Now, they I guess, are a state body, a regulatory board?
No, they're, they're a private group. And right
they're
now,
how do they have the force of law behind them?
Well, they don't yet, but they will. It's right now it's voluntary, but it's going to become required.
Well, you can't, Dad, you can't practice. No hospital would hire you if you weren't board certified.
So
it is pretty much forced in a way.
Yeah. When I say it's going to become required, it's going to be tied to licensure. It's going to be tied to your licensure pretty soon.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, I see what you mean.
Yeah.
But it is complete waste of time. And in fact, AAPS, it was interesting, they sent out an email survey asking, because, you know, they're fighting this. They're actually trying to change it dramatically, which would be wonderful. They asked us how many hours and then to turn it into how many, like, salary dollars we would basically spend on this a year. It was interesting. I mean, I calculated mine was, you know, at, like, close to $20,000 in hours of just all this stuff we have to do for the, I mean, just questions you have to answer.
Dollars. Plus, you had to pay them a total, including that test, maybe of $5,000, a fee for recertification? Or is that
The fees, everything for fee-wise, it was $3,000. But, you know, the time you spend away from your practice, away from your home, that you're sitting at your desk doing chart reviews, you're filling out stupid things like what zip code was this person from, and did they have Medicare or private insurance, and if so, what kind of insurance? It's tons of hours. So it adds up. A lot of people responded with high numbers like that had responded to the survey through AAPS.
And Morgan, can I say something about MOC? Maintenance of certificate has never been validated, and it really doesn't indicate the professional skills of a physician. A lot of people think it's a scam to bring in money for the boards, and it's also a way to enforce conformity to desired societal agendas.
Yes, go ahead, Brenda.
No, I was just going to tell you there was an option. You can pick from all these different options, and one was a patient survey. And I thought, well, you know, I have a pretty good reputation. People come to me, pay money to come to me, so clearly I would do pretty well in this. So I order them. You have to order them. They come in the mail. You know, it's like you have to do like 240 of them in a packet. And I read the questionnaire, and then I threw them in the trash. They were questions like, Does the doctor's receptionist answer the phone quick enough? Do you feel like you got referred to a specialist within your reasonable amount of, like, what you thought you should have been referred? I mean, but that depends on how full your specialists are in the area. You know, around here, neurology is so full, I can't get anyone in for 3 to 4 weeks, even if I call. So there were questions that were, like, ridiculous, had nothing to do with my skills. I mean, even my empathy, nothing. It was how someone answered my phones and how I referred someone quickly enough. So They're kind of ridiculous questions.
That's interesting because it's been described as imposing eternal costs and repeated courses and exams that have nothing to do with anything, one physician thought.
Yeah, it's like a lot of continuing education.
That's what Brenda's describing here.
And, you know, you have to help someone. Like, if I had a patient fill out that survey, you know, I'd have to – my nurse would have to take time and help them fill it out because you either call in on the phone to answer it or you do it online. Well, half my patients – don't get on the internet. So, I mean, that's tons of time away from my practice as well.
We here at the Guerrilla Media Network welcome your calls. So I got a couple of very interesting physicians, and look at how important medicine is to our health. The number here is 218-862-9829. Now, Dr. Jerome Arnett in West Virginia, you mentioned in Randolph County, this goes to the issue of trust, that some of the population doesn't trust the local doctors. We've got Medicare cutbacks. This must lead to a good deal of invisible or not seen suffering. Tell us about that.
Yes, I believe that occurs. It's, of course, the famous seen versus unseen economic problem.
Yes.
It happens. It's just not seen.
We've got to give you more time to answer that question, Dr. Jerome Barnett Jr. This is the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and we're due for a break. So please join us to discuss American medicine with two physicians. Other side of the break.
How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look?
Ever ask yourself, where do the towers go? Well, if you want the truth, if you can handle the truth, tune in Thursdays and Fridays from 5 till 7 Pacific Coast Time. Dr. Judy Wood is doing a program called ICU PSYOP Recovery Program, addressing your questions, your curiosities, your mysteries regarding that fateful day. So it's a character-driven production on Guerrilla Media Network, 5 to 7, Thursdays and Friday evenings, Pacific Coast Time. If you can handle the truth, tune in.
Get your credit repaired today at GreatCreditNow.com. We'll help remove bankruptcies, judgments, foreclosures, and late payments from your credit reports.
Great Credit Now was phenomenal. I was able to reestablish my credit. I even bought a brand new car. Thanks, Great Credit Now.
Great Credit Now helps some of our customers lower their interest rates and save money.
Save time and save money, and get approved for the new car or home you want without crazy interest rates or high payments. Call now for your free credit consultation, 800-258-0653.
Give me a ticket for an aeroplane. Ain't got time to take a fast train. Lonely days are gone, I'm a-going home. My baby just wrote me a letter. I don't care how much money I gotta spare. Got to get back to my baby.
Welcome back to the Reynolds Review. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and we at the Guerrilla Media Network do welcome your calls at number 218-862-9829. And this afternoon, I'm interviewing Dr. Jerome Arnett Jr. from West Virginia, a pulmonologist, and his daughter who followed his path into medicine, Dr. Brenda Arnett, internist in Winchester, Virginia. And we need to talk about public policy a little more systematically. And my before we go direct to Obamacare and what a train wreck that's going to be, I want to ask you who the good guys are fighting for sensible policies toward the practice of medicine and healthcare. And a couple of them come to mind because one we've already mentioned, the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons. And another one I worked for part-time for some years was the National Center for Policy Analysis, headquartered in Dallas, Texas, and led by John C. Goodman. And he has a new book out. What is it called? It's called Priceless: Curing the Healthcare Crisis. And he, some people say, maybe John included, that he's the father of health savings accounts or medical savings accounts. So there are some maybe more sensible ways to handle these third-party payment systems. Who should we listen to in the whole public lobbying and education area? Jerry, you want to pick up on that?
Yes, I agree. John Goodman is one of the incredible geniuses of the whole area. But for example, you mentioned the AAPS. They have on April 23rd regarding Brenda's problem that you can see maintenance of certification. Before we go on to Goodman, April 23rd, you'd be interested in the. In the lawsuit that the Association of American Physicians and Surgeons slapped against the American Board of Medical Specialties, and they claim that
MOC, maintenance certification, cost thousands of dollars of unjustified expenses, you can hear from Brenda's story, and taken hundreds of hours from patient care, and that from your point of view, Morgan, it violates antitrust laws and reduces access by patients to physicians. For example, and then they point out that of the big boys that are fostering this on the docs, for example, the American College of Physicians Board of Governors, only 4% of them recertify each year or whenever it's required.
Uh-huh.
So what's good for the goose isn't good for the gander.
Hey, earlier you mentioned validation. By that, do you mean there's no evidence ever produced that this certification process produces any good outcomes?
That's right. It's never been validated by any studies.
Yes.
It's kind of like imposing a belief system on doctors who may have other opinions, but will be required to follow your opinion. But no studies have done it, and so one of the points of the AAPS lawsuit is that it's fraudulent. It's a false claim that this helps improve patient care. That's been true for many years, and
These wonders of science don't practice science when they impose these costly bureaucratic obstacles.
Yeah.
Dr. Brenda Arnett, can you add anything to that?
I'm so frustrated with that maintenance certification right now. It definitely is not improving my practice. I feel like it's a waste of time. I feel like it's a waste of money. I feel like I am a little data entry rat. I'm sorry, but I do for them.
Yes.
And studying for a test. I've been learning some from it. I get that part of it. I just don't understand this practice improvement to try and sort of. I guess it kind of reminds me of our task force that we have, the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, that comes up with guidelines. You know, to tell us, yes, you should check a PSA on a patient or not. And a lot of times there's like a lot of financial issues in their recommendations. For example, it's not worth the money to check this. And there's no individualized, and we were talking about this earlier, but there's just no individual patient portion to these guidelines.
Yeah.
So, you know, they actually recommend against checking a PSA at the moment. So,
can I make a point here?
Yes.
This is a good example of the authorities insisting that doctors stop getting these useless, expensive lab tests that don't show anything, yet they're testing the death out of the doctors to make sure that they'll do something that's not indicated, and it's just the opposite of what they claim to be in favor of, which is, you know, saving money.
Yes.
And the thing about it is, you know, we've had systems for thousands of years to take care of patients, but the Medicare Center for Medicare Studies now is entering their second round of grants in order to discover a better way to deliver health care. Can you believe it? They're going to spend $1 billion this second round, and they haven't even gotten the results of the first round of innovative suggestions that they paid all this huge money for, and it's too soon to find out if it works. Now they're on a second stage, and I guess there's a third and fourth stage. I don't know.
Yes, Dr. Brenda Arnett, go ahead.
I'm laughing at my father.
Okay.
It's true. We get all fired up. I'm sorry. I'm enjoying his fire upness.
I've got to tell you guys a story about my experience there in 93, 94 on Capitol Hill, where we defeated Hillary Care, and I and a cast of 1,000 basically harpooned it, bled it to death, and it never got to a vote in the Senate or in the House on the floor. And early on, I said, you know, how can you beat this thing? Well, in comparative economic systems, one of the things you do is put up a bureaucratic chart, especially for the centralized economy. And I said, we'll do a chart of what Hillary Care is like, okay? And we have all these lines going to different boxes, and they probably couldn't get it in a book the size of the Bible under the Affordable Health Care Act, you know, the Obamacare. But anyway, we ran it with Dick Armey, who was my boss, in the Wall Street Journal on the editorial page. And I figured I earned my lifetime salary because Professor Ronald Coase, who won a Nobel Prize in economic science, once said, if an economist delays at one regulation for 90 days in his lifetime, he's earned his lifetime salary.
That's great.
And what we have to do, it seems to me, is to have better propaganda, you know, to fight all this stuff, because we're being overwhelmed by this whole interventionist system. What are we going to do, you know? In other words, if I were actually in this battle, I'd be thinking hard about that propaganda effort.
Well, the problem is, in order to have a propaganda effort, you have to use evidence and facts to convince others that you have a point. And we're fighting maybe 100 years of public school system, which doesn't train our citizens to be able to think that way. They're trained to be, you know, groupies and good people, but
that goes to the heart of the matter. Yes,
it's an educational problem. But now, in the 20th of May, Wall Street Journal this week, you know, John Goodman has an article where he points out that since January the 1st, HHS has issued 13,000 pages of Obamacare regulations.
That's HHS's Medicare, Human and Health Services.
ACA is the Obamacare.
HSS. I was just explaining what HHS
is. HHS is the one that issues the regs, the Health and Human Services. They issue the regs. Yes. So, but anyway, the point is that there will be a lot of the health plan chains won't participate. Only half the states have decided they'll participate, and the small business exchanges won't be ready because they're too expensive and too complex. And
you know, I forgot. I've come up here to North Arkansas on this camping work expedition for Nurse Pat, and I forgot. I cut a couple of articles out of the paper, which were pretty much knee slappers for me. They were written by these bureaucrat politician administrators for Obamacare, you know, the patient protection and affordable, we ought to have in quotes, care act. And it was just how wonderful it's going to be. And one of the things that comes up is, you know, Obama promised that if you're happy with your plan and physicians and care, you can continue that. But what he didn't tell you was that none of these plans can change anything substantial like deductibles or any of the financial parameters, which means they're going to go by the board within a few years anyway. In other words, the whole thing is a preposterous scheme that they're certainly going to create jobs in the government, you know, but they're going to harm patient care.
The latest news this week is that even the labor unions now are revolting.
Good for them. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, all this depends. It's why it's so complex. It depends on information technology. The government spends $80 billion a year on information technology, and most of this is wasted because it doesn't turn out anything. For example, the government has 24,000 websites and more than 10,000 separate information technology systems, and many of their projects, when they're finished, don't even work, as this is what Goodman points out in the Wall Street Journal.
Sure, yeah.
So, meantime, we have many large private exchanges that are up and running. There's over 100 of these working today, but the government can't seem to get its act going, you see.
Well, but, you know, the good side of that is this incompetence means we don't get all the government we pay for.
Well, the problem is that this incompetence also occurs in the IRS, and guess who's going to enforce the 47 provisions of Obamacare on taxes and regulations? That's the IRS.
That is a powerful thing.
Oh,
Yeah, they're going to have to administer the penalties and all that. And just
talk about incompetence.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's a powerful thing. And I wonder what, you know, there's a bunch of activists who are trying to stop Obamacare from being implemented. I guess that's a problem on Capitol Hill. The Congress would have to override Obama, I guess. I don't know if that's realistic at all.
That's probably not realistic. But the House Ways and Means Committee just recently estimated the compliance for Obamacare will require 127 million hours. I guess that's a year.
That's for openers. Yeah, it's affordable because your time, all your labor is spent free of charge for the government. It's like Brenda's maintenance of certification. Oh, Lord, love it.
The frightening thing is the IRS is going to get billions of dollars more in funding to hire thousands more employees. And one of the main authors of the bill, Max Baucus, you know, famously said recently, oh, this is a train wreck.
Yes. Yes. And finally, he's being realistic about it. He would have these people who are going to administer this thing testify, and it was just chaos. Right.
Yep.
Oh, man. Well, Brenda, are you optimistic? You're kind of optimistic in a way. It's creating demand for independent practitioners and independent physicians.
Yeah. I am, because I think it's going to be so bad that people are going to turn to the light, as I say,
yeah,
the less government intervention side to get better care. I think if people are smart, they're just going to turn that way. But, I mean, I could be wrong. I mean, I really learned a lot from AAPS. In fact, I got some ideas on how to start my own practice from a member of, you know, that I met way back in the day. I just think they really fight a lot, and they're a positive way. I mean, if you read their newsletter, it keeps you going. But it is depressing.
Great. And you mentioned there's some traffic heading to India or Costa Rica to find lower cost yet quality medical care.
Correct. I mean, I have 50% Medicare patients, but I do still have quite a few without insurance. And so pretty much on a daily basis, I deal with, you know, how much is this going to cost the average person? So what's becoming more popular is to, you know, seek out some special clinics in the developing countries that are usually run by American physicians that don't have a middleman. So their cost to do, say, a hip replacement is $5,000 or so, or, you know, instead of the, you know, $60,000, it would be done here. And they're actually very well run and very skilled physicians. So I hear the music.
Very interesting. I had no idea about that until you mentioned it. You are listening to The Reynolds Reveal. This is Morgan Reynolds, and I'm interviewing two very able physicians from West Virginia and his daughter, the internist in Virginia. And we're going to do our last segment. 12 minutes to go. We got to pack a lot in that last segment. So hurry back.
Pittman & Davis is a family-owned company that's been in business for over 80 years, specializing in delivery of fresh fruit, smoked meats, cheeses, pastries, and other scrumptious gift food items.
What's more, Pittman & Davis gift food selections are meticulously prepared to ensure the finest quality possible and made in small batches to be shipped fresh daily.
Pittman & Davis, fresh fruits and gifts since 1926. Visit the PeteSantilliShow.com/gift right now to see their selections.
Get your credit repaired today at GreatCreditNow.com. We'll help remove bankruptcies, judgments, foreclosures, and late payments from your credit reports.
Great Credit Now was phenomenal. I was able to reestablish my credit. I even bought a brand new car. Thanks, Great Credit Now.
Great Credit Now helps some of our customers lower their interest rates and save money.
Save time and save money. And get approved for the new car or home you want without paying the interest rate or high payments. Call now for your free credit consultation. 800-258-0653.
Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds. And if you would like to call in, this is your last opportunity to call Drs. Arnett here in this on this show. So the number is 218-862-9829. That number again, 218-862-9829. Well, one of the issues that we haven't touched on that I'm curious about was there used to be a lot of public commotion about malpractice insurance premiums being so high and rising and impeding physician incomes and degrees of freedom. So that seems to have fallen into recess somehow. And I was wondering, Dr. Jerome Arnett, where is that? Is that a local problem? Is that diminished or is it improved at all?
I believe these laws that regulate this are state-based. I'm not sure about that. And I think that several states have passed laws to change the way the system works. I think Texas is one of them, and I know West Virginia is one, and that seems to have helped quite a bit where it's been passed.
Okay, where they're, you know, these are the anti-trial lawyer, taming the trial lawyers, and so – outrageous settlements are fewer or are capped, that kind of thing. Yeah.
That's a great way to put it about the trial lawyers. I like that.
I've got a son who's an attorney, and so I know about that natural friction between the MDs and the lawyers. Yeah. So, Dr. Brenda Arnett, what about this malpractice insurance problem?
We have a cap in Virginia. So, and at the time when I was, well, I'm licensed in three states, but at the time when I was figuring out where I was going to practice, there was not one in West Virginia. Dad, is there one now? I didn't think that they had one.
I think they passed one that's improved things here.
Okay. So that's made it a lot nicer in the state of Virginia. We still have some crazy state regulations, though. So despite me not delivering babies, I'm not family practice, I'm not OB, I pay $400 a year to the Neurological Birth Fund for the state of Virginia, and that's to help cover lawsuits for OB-GYNs that get sued, you know, after the fact. I think you have up to – you can sue your obstetrician, I think, until the child is, like, 17. I mean, there's a huge number of years. I can't remember exactly. So, I mean, we are not without – some strange regulations here.
So that's all practicing MDs are paying into that fund. That's really...
You have to. You can get an exception if you're a resident, and that's it. So you have to pay it. It's mandatory.
Okay. Now, you are the third generation MD, Dr. Brenda, and I was wondering what would you advise you? And I raised this question earlier in another forum, but it reminds me a bit of, you know, somebody who's really ambitious, maybe creative, innovative, conscientious, wouldn't go in the old days into the railroad industry because it was so regulated and dull and played out and didn't seem to have scope for this kind of the creative mind. So you might go into... you know, software or, you know, you're a Steven Jobs too, that kind of thing is where the ambitious, or you want to go to Wall Street or these other glamorous things. So what would you, what do you see about the future for bright and eager potential physicians? Would you advise them to go in or would you try and discourage them?
I mean, I would try and discourage them. I would. But I think, you know, if they're like me, they're going to do it anyway. And I think there's a way to do it if we can, you know, as long as Obama doesn't pass any more I mean, if we can do it the way I'm doing it, it's extremely enjoyable. It's rewarding. And I wouldn't change it for another thing.
Hey, that's wonderful to hear. Yeah.
But can I put in something, Morgan? I'd like to mention that we have no idea what will happen because many of the regulations under the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare haven't yet been promulgated, and we have no idea the type of restrictions we'll be facing. There's no way you can predict that. So, you know, it could be fair like it is now, or it could be horrible like it is in Great Britain, where private medicine, I think, is largely outlawed.
Yeah, Peter, there are ways.
Soon we'll have 13,000 new regulations a month, and we'll really learn what's going to happen. But, okay, Dr. Brenda Arnett, go ahead.
I was just going to say there are some, in this community, it's been nice. If I have someone without insurance,
incredible story tonight, Jim Sparks.
I'm sorry. Oh, I thought someone else was saying something. You can call another private physician. Like, if I need an echocardiogram on a patient that doesn't have insurance, it's kind of nice. I can call a private cardiology group and say, you know, this patient doesn't have insurance. What can you do? And, I mean, there are ways to work around the price inflation, although it is still ridiculous. I mean, I have a hepatitis C patient that has no insurance. And you can cure yourself of hepatitis C, but it costs $80,000 a year. So you go to India, you can get that treatment for hundreds of dollars. There's ways around it. So
yeah.
I think it's positive. I think if someone loves medicine, I think they should do it. I was one of very few people in my entire Georgetown residency class that did private medicine, though. So it's rare. It's a dying breed, I think. But it may swing back. Putting a positive flair on this.
Well, I like that. Sure. And young people, I know when I was teaching at Texas A&M, some students would come up to me because I used a certain book which gave an optimistic look at things. And they said, you know, there's so much negativity. And there is.
There is.
There is. Yes. And it's good to hear your kind of bright outlook. Okay? Where there's life, there's hope.
When you sleep well at night and you take good care of people, it just gives you a better outlook, I think.
But I like to say that in order to love medicine, you love to be able to do your job and help other people. You have to be effective, and in order to do that, you have to have freedom.
True.
Freedom is all going to be taken away with Obamacare. You'll be treating the regulations instead of the patients.
Hey, I just came across a quote that I'd not seen before from Adam Smith. And he said, if a man is in good health and is free of debt and has a clear conscience, what more do you need to be happy?
Wonderful.
And Dr. Jerry Arnett and Dr. Brenda Arnett, I love that because you're talking about a clear conscience. You can sleep at night as an independent physician. You know you've done what is worth doing for the patient.
Yeah, it is. It is wonderful.
That's such a success. There's a warm feeling you've really done well by your patients. Dr. Jerry Arnett, did you do in your practice or maybe into today a lot of black lung treatment? And that was highly involved with the government program, wasn't it? I mean, in West Virginia, coal mining and all. Did you do a lot of black lung patient work?
Yes, I started pulmonary practice in 1975, and for the first 20 or 30 years, I had a lot of those types of patients, yes.
Yes, okay. And how did you mesh or get around? Because I have this impression that that was highly involved, the federal government, the Black Lung Treatment Program.
Yes, that's true. But in those days, the restrictions on your freedom to make choices for your patients weren't nearly what they have been the last 15 years, see? So
okay. That's
not nearly such a problem. And the federal program paid, if the patient was able to get the political designation of a black lung attached to his health records, then the government, you see, would pay for most of that, and the patient could afford to come to the physician and get the kind of care that they needed, see.
Hey, you and your co-author, Dr. Dunn, I believe is his name, did an article at the end of 2011 regarding bioethics. And it's scary. You quoted a Dr. Don Berwick. I mean, when you see the It's great talking to you two physicians because you have traditional morals, ethics, concern for the patient. And these other people that are, will run to these programs are not going to be like you two are. This Don Berwick in particular, what did he say? Excellent healthcare is by definition redistributional. So what the heck does that mean, right?
That's right. Morgan, you have to understand that these liberals don't understand ethics, don't understand liberty or freedom and how important it is, or private property. And the liberals and socialists are all class warfare. It's class against class, and it's everybody against everybody's throats. It's terrible.
Yes.
And see, I learned this at an early age.
Yes. Hey, this is the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and I thank very much Dr. Jerome Arnett Jr., pulmonologist, West Virginia, and his daughter, Dr. Brenda Arnett in Winchester, Virginia, internist, for your magnificent contribution to our public understanding of what is going on in the world of medicine. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Morgan, for bringing it to the public light. It's very important.
Thank you, Morgan. It's been wonderful.
Thank you. Okay,
we'll
great. We got to. We'll have to have an update after January 1 with Obamacare.
Full. Yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Hopefully I'll be just as positive.
Yes.
All right. Thank you, Morgan.
Okay.
We really enjoyed
Thank
it.
You, Brenda Arnett and Jerome Arnett. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.